Donald Trump and the remaining days of his presidency on this uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up, do the right thing. For a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenz, and joining me today from Studio C, and I say that because it suspiciously looks like a bedroom closet, is Tim Donner. Tim, thank you so much for joining.
A bedroom closet with a cityscape backdrop? That doesn't happen very often.
I seem to have seen the cityscape part at the seam there for a moment, but all right. It is day 9 of the coup, I think, depending on how a person counts. I'm counting from the Wednesday after Election Day, thinking that, you know, give him the night to kind of fret about it. But then if he doesn't come out the very next day and give Joe Biden a good old attaboy and hit the bricks and just really leave early, because that's what America's, you know, if I look at CNN, that's what America wants. Tim, they wanted Donald Trump. Really, he should have just left that night, election night. He should have realized, you know, that's what was happening. So we're going to have to deal with it.
He probably should have left, you know, about 4 years ago. He probably should have just he probably should have just admitted on November 8th, 2016, that the Russians just fixed the vote. All right. They fixed it. I give up. Turn it over to Hillary Clinton. Then maybe he could have run again this year and probably would have beaten her.
You know, we lived through the Donald Trump was a Russian agent, basically. Then he wasn't a Russian agent, but he was in league. He was dirty somehow. We just needed the taxes to figure it out. And then it was that he's going to call off the elections somehow. These things are never clearly defined, you know, how the mechanics of him calling the elections off, but it's in the wind and they'll report on it. And Brian Stelter will ask people, do you think he could do something like that? And they'll, you know, they'll sit there and the neocons, they'll be like very sternly, well, anything's possible. I'd hate to see what would happen if, you know, feeding the fire. Well, it never happened. And here's how Tim, I just think this story in like a microcosm of the whole thing right now, that the whole thing, which is that this fascist who we were warned about from some Republicans and every Democrat, I think, poses an existential threat to America. And you know what else, Tim? American democracy, and therefore democracy writ large worldwide, this tyrant. Do you know what the latest threat is that he's going to do on the way out the door?
I dread to think, Scott.
He's sufficiently disengaging us from the war in Afghanistan that's gone on longer than like a half a generation of lives in America.
We can't have that. How many presidents spent time making sure we would stay in Afghanistan? Well, only two, but for 16 years. Okay.
He fired the former Raytheon lobbyist who's the current Secretary of Defense. And apparently because, gee, Tim, that person wants more war. So on his way out the door, the fascist, okay, the guy who we had to be most careful of, not, you know, with power because of his unquenching thirst for it and what he would do with it, uses it to do what? To bring home troops engaged in a foreign war, which is supposed to be, if we read our history books, one of the worst endeavors of the state is to engage in foreign wars. But that's what Trump's doing on his way out the door, right? Who's that a payoff to exactly?
Well, I have to say, Scott, I appreciate you referring to Mark Esper first, as a Raytheon lobbyist. And then as the Secretary of Defense. He's not often referred to that way. Usually they just go right to SecDef. So, look, Trump's got more than 60 days left to do basically whatever he wants to complete his work. And one of the things that I said after this election is that a lot of Trump's work, really most of it, arguably all of it, is either done or well on the way to being done.
You think somehow, Tim, maybe the private sector is going to find a home for him, for Mr. Esper, when his minimum term.
I think he might make $5,000 or $10,000 more in the private sector than he did as the Secretary of Defense. Just a hunch, Scott.
So for people who don't know how this works is, this guy gets paid to pick up the phone because he can get anybody on the phone over at the DOD or any of the other agencies that buy trillions of dollars worth of stuff. And because of that access that he has, he can leverage that into a giant payday. He did before, he will again. It's again the whole thing where Trump to me is, he's done something so great with dialing down the war in Afghanistan. Like this is a never ending war for us. And one person's doing something about it.
You know, Scott, it's kind of paradoxical because on the one hand, Trump pumped up military spending. It's one of the things that he boasted of during his campaign. And he had a lot to back it up. And yet at the same time, there was a commensurate commitment to not using the military, unlike any president since our lifetimes. I can hardly think of one. He's the first president in at least, I'm going to say 30, 40 years that actually ramped down our foreign involvement as opposed to ramping it up. So on the one hand, he's making us stronger than ever with a powerful military rebuilt from the Obama era. And on the other hand, he has a great reluctance to use it, believing that, you know, peace through strength. What Reagan said, if you build up a big enough military, no one's going to mess with you. Pretty simple proposition.
It's the act of a tyrant, Tim, to take these foreign troops home right before.
Yeah, that's
right.
Great.
Before he leaves office. Right.
The act of a tyrant to bring troops home and bring
these kind of stakeholders, Raytheon, McDonnell Douglas, all these defense contractors are not offered a seat at the table here. And the fancy generals too, Tim. This kind of wanton reduction of violence, this unilateral reduction in violence that the president of the United States on his way out the door is engaging in. I don't know what we can do to stop it maybe some kind of last minute impeachment. I don't even know if that's a thing, but whatever we can do, the Washington Post certainly and other of the
respectable
publications,
right.
They are really worried about this. That's from the editorial board, by the way, this kind of caution about this troop reduction in Afghanistan. I mean, who knows what could happen, Tim, if this guy's allowed another month in office or two even without the kind of adults in the room like former Defense Department officials in order to guide him.
You know, let's talk about something that we we haven't talked about it recently, but we have in the past, and it's the whole issue of how the left, which used to be a peace movement in general, anti-war, anti the machinery of war, anti the Defense Department, anti big military budgets, you know, now suddenly, I guess, because it's Trump actually bringing our involvement down, suddenly now they're the party of war. Joe Biden, compare Joe Biden's record with Donald Trump when it comes to war. Joe Biden never saw a war he wasn't in favor of. Essentially voted for the Iraq war. Excuse me, Trump was against it.
Tim, that's inconvenient for other people to hear, I think, to hear that Donald Trump is going to be a more peaceful president. No, Joe Biden, we're going to have a new war, to be sure. Maybe it'll be Kamala's war or Kamala's war. I always forget. I got yelled at the other day by wrongfully pronouncing that person's name. But
it'll be interesting to see, you know, how people react to getting us in involved in a foreign war after we've had 4 years where we haven't been involved. I mean, because this is 4 years where we've drawn down. Are people now going to suddenly support ramping up again?
Tim, nothing's going to make Joe Biden look more presidential than when he's standing in that coffin bay hangar at, in Delaware, where they bring the bodies home.
The Wilmington White House?
it's the Newark Air Force. There's a big Air Force base in Newark, Delaware, and that's where they do it. And that's literally where, I mean, that's where Reagan, you know, it is a famous photo op-y place, the coffin draped bodies. And I mean, I just think that, I mean, the point again is Donald Trump was a great president for in this area. And I think anybody who loves liberty can agree with that, regardless of what they may think of any other provision that he may have advocated for. And I hope that the American people, Tim, continue to press on Joe Biden. You know, there was that one war that Obama tried to start in Syria. That was the last time, I think, we had a kind of a new war on the table. And the American people, you'll recall, rejected it resoundingly from all across the political spectrum, yeah, Republicans and Democrats.
But not until Obama had already said that if Syria crossed the red line about chemical weapons, that he would be committed to action. So he should have done one thing or the other, but you can't do both. You can't draw a red line or a line in the sand and then not cross it. What you can do is not draw the red line, not say anything, and then
you get into war that way. I'm saying, though, it was a great thing. The American people choose to reject war more than embrace it. And we get a bad rap in that regard. So in any case, this is 11/13/2020 at 3:41 p.m. I say that because we will talk a little bit, I think, Tim, about the state of the legal filings in election related law.
It's all in Pennsylvania.
It's at this point, I think that there's no way that Donald Trump is sworn in as the next president of the United States. Do you still see a path there that you think is something that's a reasonable possibility?
I don't look at this as a pathway so much as the establishment of a legal basis to question the whole issue of whether there was widespread fraud. And then you attack the question of what happens then. I mean, in other words, I think we need to see what these courts decide, what the Supreme Court decides on Pennsylvania, what the other courts decide in Michigan and Arizona and elsewhere. And then we can decide what to do with these court decisions, if there are any that are consequential overturn.
You have painted the landscape of where things are. And now I'm asking you about your predictive powers, Tim.
No, of course not.
Okay.
No, of course I don't think so, not at this point. However, I will just say this. I don't think we've seen even the beginning of what the Trump legal team, campaign team is going to reveal in terms of the credible affidavits about fraud that would affect, you know, hundreds of thousands of votes if you count all the states where these affidavits, and they're mounting, Scott. The affidavits, which you can explain exactly how they carry the force of testimony, of law, they're mounting, and they can't just be ignored. Now, what the end result of that is, I don't know. At this point, can he overturn this state or that? I don't think that's the question so much as can we establish that yes or no, there was voter fraud, having to do it piecemeal through different courts in different states, some state, some federal courts, right?
Yeah, it's going to have to be on a state by state basis, because what you're, I think you've said it many times, is that there's not one election for president. There's 50 different elections for president.
Right.
And so you're attacking, or they're attacking, several of those election results. The Pennsylvania case, you know, there's fake news on both sides, Tim. And that happened this week on the right side of the aisle, when the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court ruled that some mail-in ballots basically were going to be tossed. And, you know, it's one of these stories where you can tell there's something wrong with the story by what they're not saying. And I kept reading this story, and somebody who sent me an early link to a reporting on it, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't get the whole story. And the reason why I couldn't get the whole story is because they were selling a narrative that this was a major development for the Trump campaign, and it wasn't. It may be, 1,000 votes or something like that. You know, now it's a drop in a bucket, and could it be a situation could it be a situation where every drop helps? Maybe, but this was sold as something that it wasn't. So, for people who don't know what the ruling was, is when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that people were going to get 3 additional days to have their vote delivered by mail. So they still had to vote by election day, but that the counters were going to accept deliveries of those votes 3 days past election day. The Secretary of State also said that if somebody submitted a ballot and they couldn't prove who they were, they had a few extra days to prove who they were by coming back with an ID or some other way of substantiating it. And the Commonwealth Court, which is an intermediate appellate court in intermediate state appellate court in Pennsylvania, said those particular votes, so the votes had to come in after election day, and also have a dispute about the identity, those were cast aside and not counted.
Right. I think, what the Trump side has tried to do is, pardon the pun, but trump up the idea that this is just a trickle before the flood. Of anecdotal and yet, testimony by affidavit about incidents of fraud. For example, one report that from somebody giving sworn testimony, saying that he was an election worker and was instructed specifically to put in false birth dates, specifically January 1st, 1900, for a bunch of ballots that came in that were improperly filed, that they were instructed that hundreds of ballots, thousands of ballots were supposedly, mass marked for Joe Biden. You look at the number of ballots in the battleground states where there were votes only for president, nothing else. An extraordinary number on Biden's side, very few on Trump's side. There's all this kind of stuff. Some of it is factual based on the numbers, and some of it is based on sworn testimony of people who witnessed or even had to participate in election fraud.
Yeah, I think that it's important for everybody to remember that in an election the size of the one that we just undertook, there are going to be many, many, many instances of fraudulent activity or behavior. And that doesn't, the aggregate of those, or adding of all those things, doesn't equal the kind of fraud that would be necessary, Tim, to overturn the results of the election. I think,
well, it has to be done, again, on a state by state basis. And I think, what they'd count on is if they look, it has to be systemic. It can't be incident based. It has to be widespread. It has to be.
Yeah.
It has to be essentially proven that there was a scheme.
I can tell you right now, the best shot they have, and it's going to I'll announce in advance, it's going to fail. And I'd be interested to be proven wrong on this, but the best shot they have to me is to say that the large portion of ballots that were processed without poll watchers present, or whatever they're calling them in lieu of the word poll watcher, but independent inspector of the counting process. There were many, many, many thousands of votes, especially in the heavily Democrat areas where that happened. And if they could get the courts to agree that the opening and inspection of those votes with somebody who wasn't who is an independent party or Republican in this case, that is the chance they have for the court to then say, okay, throw those that ballots out, don't count them, and only count the other, and then he could, I think, get the votes to win. But
seems to me that what he needs to do is to press the case. Now, tell me where along the way I might be wrong, but he needs to press the case that all the ballots that were received after November 3rd, all of them,
every
single
that,
one of them should be discounted.
They are. They're already making that case.
Right. I understand that. Yeah. But if they win that's a big win, because that's, you know, tens of maybe hundreds of thousands of ballots. And what do you want to bet? A significant number of them are from, say, Montgomery County around Philadelphia or from Philadelphia itself.
Well, the word, Tim, from the sort of internet, I'll just say it that way because I don't have good numbers to bring to the table. But the word is that even if that were to happen, that there are enough votes for Biden to carry the day with the other vote totals. So I expect that's true. I don't expect there were that many ballots delivered. Again, these are people who are voted by mail who didn't get their vote delivered to their county boards of election until several days after the election day. I just don't think the totals are there based on what I've seen chatter-wise online. So I think they have to get to this other larger chunk of votes and get those stricken down. And if they can do that, then they're going to have a big win. But I'll tell you this, I don't think there's really anything there in terms of the fraud claims, Tim. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the New York Times has called all of the 50 states election judges, and they've all reported no widespread instances of fraud.
Oh, okay. All right. Then forget everything I just said for the last, 15 minutes?
And so
all
that's
right.
Just
if the New York Times said it, then I retract.
Letter. It's not I even retract. That they said it. Can you, I mean, I don't know. Is it beating a dead horse to discuss how bankrupt
call
they are?
Right. Call election officials.
The head of the
In Democrat-run right. states and right. ask them if there was any election fraud. And they right. say no. And you yeah. go, okay, well, that proves there was no election
fraud. I called the chief of police to ask if the cops were mistreating people out at the protest. And he said, no, they weren't mistreating anybody. So, no need to send somebody out there. Just hang up the phone, right?
Scott, the last 15, 20 minutes we spent, that's 20 minutes we'll never get back talking about something that now has been proven to be false, because the very people who would perpetrate election fraud have confirmed that there was no fraud. Final word.
I think we can move right along then, Tim. Let's talk about your favorite topic.
Let me just say, in terms of you're saying, are you prepared to say, look, this isn't going to overturn the election. And I think the important thing before you consider one state and if those electoral votes are turned and all that kind of stuff, you have to establish that there was not any sort of, I guess, systemic organized voter fraud on any widespread basis within states and between states. But I'll tell you emotionally, while
that
I think
we have discovered.
I think, though, that even though emotionally and in my head, I say, the chances are 1 in 1,000, maybe 1 in 1,000,000. But I'm not yet prepared. I can't put myself in a place where I can start talking about the Biden administration.
Yeah, I think I got there. So when we last recorded the uprising, I definitely thought there was not a strong possibility that Donald Trump would be the next president, but not a 1 in 1,000,000 chance either. And now I think it is, maybe not 1 in 1,000,000, but I am now prepared to talk about the Biden presidency. I've gotten there over the past few days, and in fact, we will be talking about on the uprising in short order, what's to come with Biden and his administration. And by short order, I mean not on this episode, but we're not going to wait till January the 20th.
And by the way, let me just clarify. I'm not saying I'm not prepared to talk about the Biden presidency because I can't do.
No, I know what you mean. No, you just haven't internalized it to the point where
it isn't real to me yet.
Tim, both I and the audience understood what you meant. You didn't have to clarify.
Yeah, sure.
But I appreciate it. By the way, on my notes here, I have prepare for Biden to discuss.
Okay, thank you.
Preparing for his presidency. But
are you going to post the show notes?
No, we don't. Those are confidential, Tim. That was a rare behind the scenes.
I got just a tiny little glimpse, folks. He just if you were watching, see, just barely put it. I can go back, indeed, freeze that frame.
I had to count the number of days for my coup talk. That was 9 days, Tim, by the way, that the coup is ongoing. All right. You know,
you have to clarify, when you say the coup, do you mean the coup by Trump to stay in the White House or the coup to steal the election? Which coup are you talking about?
The American people voted, and he's still there, Tim.
He should have just left the same day, maybe in leg irons. He should be frog marched out of there.
From the having no sense of their own, I mean, just you'll recall that the whole thing of the Russiagate scandal came from Obama and Biden manipulating to the last second they were in office against Donald Trump. And for them to come on and be like, oh, I can't talk to the Secretary of Labor to figure out who to hire, you know, because of the transition thing. And then they come out with that fake office of president-elect. Are you kidding me?
I love that.
That alone is like, we're not dealing with serious people here. Like, idea that if you win the office, and let's just say he did, that alone commands the authority, right? The press has already called to him that. And by the way, I want to say this. I could do like a montage. I think it is really inappropriate when you have an election where there is some debate about the outcome to call somebody president-elect and not say presumptive. It's not that hard to call him the presumptive, if that's who you want to identify him as, right? But to call him president-elect, that happens when the electors cast their vote. In the time between that vote being cast until the president is sworn in, that person is the president-elect. And they're not the president-elect until that time.
Well, and I wrote a piece on libertynation.com about it. Is that election?
Before you say that, Tim, let's take a moment and just thank today's sponsor of the program, LibertyNation.com. Liberty Nation is a news and analysis website of conservatarian principles. It's available 24/7, 36, Tim.
366.
366. Thank you very much.
There you go.
And LibertyNation.com partners with WhatFinger. WhatFinger is a content aggregator, and more as the options for news that doesn't agree with the paymasters at Google and Facebook. You need independent sources, and WhatFinger is one. It's a good news aggregator site. Check it several times throughout the day. LibertyNation.com is a proud content partner with WhatFinger.com. You were saying, Tim.
Okay, so I wrote a piece, you know, just sort of a constitutional primer or refresher.
Or primer, even.
People think primer. Yeah, if you're from certain parts of Ohio. I don't even want to know the answer, but if you polled people out there, how many of them would think that, well, NBC called the election, ABC called the election, CBS called the election, hell, even Fox News called the election. Yes. So that makes him the president-elect. How many people do you think really believe that? I think a lot of people do, and they don't understand that the Electoral College, the 538 members, are voting on December 14th. That's a month away.
Tim, based on the internet, it seems like those people think that the not only does that happen, but it happens that night. Like, I mean, like, why is Donald Trump out of the House that night?
Why is he still in the White House?
Yeah. When you call to win America's Got American Idol or whatever, don't they tabulate that right away? And it just happens, right?
Yeah, right. I don't even, like I said, I don't even want to know how many people really believe that. But I got to tell you, I love this, that whole office of the president-elect. There's no office of president-elect. There's no such
what
office.
Genius decided that to, and then like, then you got to get the art, right? Can you like the, I mean, I just want to be a fly on the wall in the
maybe, wait a minute, wait a
the
minute.
Art for the banners and the step and repeats and all that.
I look, the step and repeats, that's good. I think I've figured it out. He's not claiming that he holds the public office of president-elect. He's claiming that he's going to be so intimate with the American people that he's inviting, he, the president-elect, is inviting us into his office. His office in Delaware at the Wilmington White House.
I can't even wrap my arms around it, Tim.
Yeah,
sorry.
I mean, I think I just figured it out, and nobody else is talking about it, Scott. You heard it here.
It's Dover Air Force Base, by the way. That's what I was thinking about before. I don't know why I couldn't even bring it to mind. Maybe it was because just the thought of again being used for these political charades with the bodies of American soldiers. Maybe I'll be proved wrong and he won't be the warmonger.
Well, he's not going to be under the pressure that he was in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
You know
what, Tim?
He was under a lot of pressure
doing when we're bombing new populations abroad, sending vulgar tweets about it. I can tell you that. And we can all rest easy knowing that when the next president engages in new foreign wars, there won't be vulgar tweets about it.
There will be the 45th president.
Yeah, but I'm saying Joe Biden won't also be tweeting vulgar words about it. So that'll make everybody feel better about the wars, is what I'm saying.
He wouldn't know how to tweet if his phone hit him over the head. I mean, just dictates it. He's not going to tweet. He probably won't tweet even once during his entire 6-month tenure in the White House.
I don't think this counts as election manipulation in any kind of way that's illegal or anything like that. But I do think it's election manipulation. I wondered if you thought, does Donald Trump, let's just say for the sake of argument right now, he's lost his reelection campaign. Right. Does he win or lose if the Pfizer vaccine news pops before the election? Does it matter? Is it a difference maker?
Probably not, because we've seen the news of it coming out now, and I don't see this groundswell of excitement about it now, even with the election over, and there's no political grounds to love it or hate it at this point. I think it's pretty clear, though. You know, whether it would have made a difference or not, it was a pretty close election in a lot of states. It might have. But the thing that's pretty clear about it, that makes it particularly, as you would say, gross and disgusting, is that it was released a week after Election Day. It's pretty obvious that it was held.
Oh, we know for sure. No, we know because of the way they communicated with the FDA for their release language. They manufactured it, their application process, so that the result would not be released until actual Election Day. We know that to be true.
But their original plan had called for a determination by the end of October. And then they altered the plan.
Yeah.
They altered it.
They didn't want Trump to get the good news. So.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, I think of all the disgusting things in politics, Scott, and there's so many of them. Politicizing a public health crisis has to be the most disgusting.
In a way that it doesn't have to be politicized, which is, that's exactly. I mean, in other words, a decision of what to shut down and when, that is a political decision.
I mean, if you have a specific, specific issue with the way the public health crisis is being handled, fine. But when you use that to pin the deaths of, 225,000 people on a president who's, you know, scurrying around trying to do everything he can and Operation Warp Speed. And they've developed, hell, Scott, they've developed a vaccine in like 8 months.
Yeah, but no national mask mandate, Tim.
It's unthinkable.
Yeah, there's a vaccine, but there's no national mask mandate still.
Yeah. Well, there will be
November 13th.
Just wait. You'll get the mandate. I know you want it.
What is the legal justification for a national? Nobody talks about that. I read this article.
It's for the kids, Scott. It's for the kids.
I read this article the other day, and it was talking about how it was saying how, like, the America could benefit from a national mask mandate and the economic consequences wouldn't be too bad. And I looked up the author's information. He's an epidemiologist. Tim, does he have a background in finance or economics? Absolutely not. He's just a doctor. Okay. And he can count the number of deaths from COVID, but he's not counting any of the other deaths that we talk about, from people losing their jobs, from suicide, from drug abuse,
you all know, of those things.
And if the reason you know why you're doing it is to save lives, then it's only it is required of you and incumbent on you to add up the lives that the other side is going to take. You know, the other side is the opposite or mirror of your actions.
You know what it is? It's another example of leftist one-step thinking. Oh, a lot of people are getting the virus. Let's just make sure people can't get it by locking them away as much as we can. Without thinking the next step, wait a minute, what's going to happen to them when they're locked away in a way that they never have been before, now that they're forced to do?
We're now getting more data out of the prisons on coronavirus, and it is shocking what we're seeing, Tim, in terms of deaths in jail and prison populations. And a lot of these people, Tim, were not even convicted of a crime. You know, the people are arrested, charged with a crime and not convicted, and they're getting killed by coronavirus while being locked up.
Well, I'll tell you what, this third wave could be the worst, Scott, could be the worst of the three, because it's coming in winter. Before it came in spring, late winter, spring, then in the summer, in an isolated area, but in the winter, that's always what people have been the most afraid of, because more people are inside and then it spreads more easily. On the other hand, we know how to deal with it better.
You know, if one thing I'm almost certain of is that in 2024 for the presidential election, Tim, Cuomo will be running. I'm pretty confident of that. And he has said that no more than 10 people can congregate at a home in
no more than 10 people
State.
Will be allowed into the Democratic presidential field in 2024.
Yeah. place your bet now, because it's going to be a packed field. It is kind of interesting seeing some of those, you know, this is kind of a, I don't know, is it untoward to say fun? I don't mean it that way. It's fascinating to see the internal fight now of who's going to be exercising the power in the Biden administration and where it's going to rest, with the more progressive side or the kind of uniparty types. And I think they're going to win. I don't think we're going to see a lot of progressive presence in the administration. I think it's going to be uniparty types and carryover from Obama.
Well, the reason you're correct is that the one thing all politicians have in common is an eye on the next election. It's always about the next election. It's always about maintaining their power and the best way to do that. Now, in this election, you know, Biden may have won, but the Democrats underperform badly in congressional elections in both the Senate and the House. They probably failed to take
and they
Senate.
Won't have Donald Trump to run against next time around.
And they won't have him to run against. And they lost seats in the House, even though Fox News said they were going to pick up seats. And boy, are they taking grief for that. But I mean, yeah, the Republicans will pick up at least six seats in the House. So Pelosi's weak.
Why would anybody watch Fox News now? I mean, in other words, if you're not a conservative, right, what's the point of watching Fox News? And if you are,
you know what,
if you are a conservative, what's the point of watching Fox News?
Right. You've made exactly the point. I made that in another piece on that I'd written about how, you know, if Fox, where's Fox going to go to replace the viewers that are abandoning them after their election coverage. Where are they going to go? Somebody watching NBC News going to suddenly start watching no. Fox, MSNBC, CNN? No, they're going to simply lose their viewership yeah. and they won't be able to replace it.
Get woke, go broke. Going to happen to them too.
You know, they just, you know, it's like the moment they saw a slight opening, they wanted to make good with the upcoming Biden administration by saying, okay, we'll give you Arizona early. We think you're going to win it. We're not at all sure, but we'll call it and that'll prove we're good guys. And maybe we'll get access to the Biden White House. Not as much as we did to the Trump White House, but, you know, just enough that we can be respectable in the eyes of the elite media, Scott.
Yeah, well, I guess it was a cold 8 years for them during the during the Biden administration. You know, the funny thing is Trump insults those people, but he at least lets them in. Right. He did try to keep Acosta out because he was literally disruptive during a press conference. But for all the rest of them, he gave them their access, something that Barack Hussein Obama did not have the grace to do when he was commander in chief. He kept Fox out and and we'll see what Biden does in that regard. All right, let's talk Obamacare. I've been trying to talk about it for a minute here. I know it's your favorite topic. The Justice Roberts saving language created a tax where there was none before. When Congress passed Obamacare, it was just a mandatory insurance policy that people had to buy. And the Supreme Court, in order to try to keep the law in place, ruled that it wasn't a mandatory insurance policy. It was just a tax. Even though they went kicking and screaming, right? The Congress said, it's not a tax. It's not a tax explicitly. That's what the Supreme Court said. Tim, I've heard the case that was in the court this week described as a giant troll for Justice Roberts, because it's entirely his invention that this was a tax is why this case is back in the Supreme Court. What happened was, for people who don't know, the Congress, when it was in Republican control, zeroed out the tax. So there's no money due if you don't have a policy. So then the question becomes, well, how can we have it be constitutional if it's based on being a tax, but yet there is no tax? Well, that got to the Supreme Court this week. And, you know, Justice Roberts, you can kind of tell through his attitude, you know, the legal blogs were kind of a Twitter about it, which is that he clearly is not a fan of this case, just generally.
Wonder why.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think when you put John Roberts in the same sentence with Obamacare, a little bit like oil and water, they just are never going to blend quite right. And, you know, I just thought of the our great Chief Justice again in this Pennsylvania case, how different things might have been if he had not sided with the progressives and had overturned the governor and Supreme Court of Pennsylvania.
It was just the Supreme Court, for the record, by the way.
Right. But the governor tried to do it. The legislature said no. The Supreme Court in Pennsylvania said yes, and the legislature's will must rule. That's constitutional. And
you know, let's unpack for just a second what the exact issue is in Pennsylvania. I think we may have talked about it before, but it's going to be the feature of this Supreme Court case. So to the extent that they grant it, and I'll give an update on that, which is a week ago Friday, Justice Alito, who was in charge of emergency appeals out of the Third Circuit, which is where Pennsylvania sits, heard their emergency appeal and basically said, we're going to make sure that the county election boards segregate the votes that arrived late so that in future court actions, they can be dealt with separately if needed. It basically allowed for the possibility of future action. It didn't guarantee anything. And he said, I'm going to forward this matter to my colleagues on the court and for action. We don't have any communication from them on that since then. In other words, there's no ruling. There's no hearing in place. There's no nothing. Donald Trump, that was an action brought by the Republican Party of Pennsylvania. Donald Trump, the campaign, has asked the court for permission to intervene in the case. They haven't addressed whether they're going to allow that or not. But what happened is that case follows from a Pennsylvania Supreme Court decision. And what that decision said was, because the Pennsylvania Constitution guarantees to the people the right to a free and fair election, that they were going to just institute new rules, even though the legislature had met after the pandemic's outbreak to devise new rules for the election within the pandemic. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania imposed itself and said, no, we're going to impose this standard to meet this state constitutional standard. And as you suggested and said, the United States Constitution gives the powers of regulating elections to state legislatures. Now, it would be different, Tim, if this was some kind of fast-acting pandemic. It hit January 1st, Election Day was February 1st, and the legislature didn't meet until March. Then it would be perhaps appropriate for the state Supreme Court to craft some judicial-made law in order to accommodate the rights of the people to have a free and fair election in a pandemic. But the legislature had the opportunity to meet and pass a new law to accommodate that needs for the people. And for the court to intercede and impose itself, the Supreme Court has previously said that's the exact wrong kind of thing for any court to do on the eve of an election because of this mess that we have now. So that's the issue, I think. Does that clearly?
Yeah, it seems like the plain language of the Constitution. And yet Chief Justice Roberts is looking at what the state legislature decided in Pennsylvania and how that ruling was overturned by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So he's got a choice of whether to pick what it says in the Constitution that the state legislature decides.
The Pennsylvania Constitution.
Pennsylvania Constitution.
Right.
Or to somehow turn things around enough to say that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania should supersede the power and the decision of the legislature. How do you justify that?
Well,
I mean, if what
Justice
kind of
Roberts, so Justice Roberts believes, and part of this is conjecture, so let me say that, but Justice Roberts believes that it's different for a federal court to rule on a state law matter than a state court to rule on a state law matter. And here, in the case that's before the United States Supreme Court now, it's a case involving the Pennsylvania Supreme Court interpreting a provision of the Pennsylvania Constitution. And it does make sense that the United States Supreme Court would want to arm's length of that ruling to say this is for Pennsylvania to decide. Now, I think
But the Supremacy Clause, Scott, the U.S. Constitution trumps the Pennsylvania Constitution if they're in conflict. And if the United States Constitution calls for the state legislatures to decide, Pennsylvania.
Tim, you're right. And just hold on a second. Right? Hold on. You're absolutely right. And if that part of the controversy was a question for the parties and briefed and argued, it would be appropriate for the court to rule on it. But that's not what we had. Remember, it was a request for an emergency ruling. And that's what the court declined to grant. And it really does make a huge difference that that's the kind of measure that was asked for rather than, I see.
Okay. Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, okay, so is an emergency order, but there's a talk about a hard deadline for a decision that's meaningful. That's Election Day, November 3rd. Everybody knows it. Everybody in the world knows that day. So you can't equate this with, let's say, an abortion clinic saying their future
client,
you know, is endangered by pro-life demonstrators haranguing them and destroying their property, and they need to, this is a presidential election.
I think it's appropriate to give a segregation order, which is in place. The votes are separate, and then they can follow up. And if there's not enough votes to make a difference, they can have an evidentiary. Or ask a lower court to have an evidentiary hearing. That's the other thing that people often don't understand is there's no witness box at the Supreme Court. They don't have the capacity, you know, to like You know, there was somebody, I saw one of these things today, Tim. It's
It's not like a Perry Mason courtroom.
Somebody posted on the office chat thing. It was like one of these old time, a chain letter, where it's like, President Trump wants you to send a piece of mail to the White House asking for a formal recount so he can use it as evidence at the Supreme Court. Like the Supreme Court cares that 42 million people sent a postcard to the White House. Yeah. It's like, it has, you know. It's not that kind of court.
Court of public opinion.
Yeah. So maybe they'll rule on their own motion or something like that. That could happen. I can tell you this, to the extent, and this is true for that Obamacare case too, Tim, to the extent that the Supreme Court can avoid making a ruling in a highly contentious area, they will avoid it as a rule. I think the smarter money bet is that they'll figure out a way to not rule on any election case and just kind of let the energy sort of peter out.
Well, also because unlike Bush v. Gore in 2000, the election doesn't hinge on that one decision that they make. In other words, in 2000, they were the last line of defense against total chaos. They had to decide essentially in 2000. This time they don't have to decide unless it's one case after another or a massive case that would affect multiple states.
With your analysis that they had to decide Florida, because Florida was going to be decided by, well, it's an interesting question. I should have to do some more research on it. I thought that the way things were going in Florida.
Well, I mean, come on. It was 537 votes that in one state that gave George Bush the narrowest possible victory. I mean, it was an impossibly close election. And what was happening in Florida was that you had select counties that were being cherry picked for recounts, the Democrat friendly counties, whereas the ones that were GOP friendly were not being recounted, and that was the unfairness of it all. And the case was lost. Basically, the Gore people had lost, and then they were brought back to life by the Florida Supreme Court, which stepped in and made an extraordinary ruling, which then forced the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, to step in and settle the chaos. Did they have to? Absolutely. Well, you know, December 14th is what federal law says the electors have to meet by then. So what if they don't? What happens then? And I think they were hard against the December 14th deadline in 2000, Scott, remember?
Well, there is something to be said for what happens if they don't, and we're not wanting to confront that as a possibility. We'll see. You know, there's lots of dates swirling around. I haven't done my daily sweep of the election litigation, but I don't think there's been any major news so far today. So we'll just keep checking in with the Supreme Court's website, and not able to schedule any time, you know, to do anything off until then, Tim. Sad to say, you know, I mean, I'm just saying, not that.
Just saying, sadly, sadly saying.
All right. Should we put a pin in it there?
Your choice, boss.
All right. Well, we were going to talk about Maine's $18 minimum wage, but we can leave that for next time. There are some smaller issues around the horn. for now, we'll just say I'm going to be reporting for LibertyNation.com, today's sponsor, live tomorrow on Saturday, the 14th, from the Trump March, or it's the Stop the Steal March, or it's the Proud Boys
Million MAGA March.
So please tune in if you're hearing this in time to LibertyNation.com for all your conservatarian news and analysis, including live on-the-spot reports from Washington, D.C. Tim from Studio C, thanks for joining. See you next time.
From parts unknown. Thanks for having me.
combat propaganda and defend freedom at Liberty Nation Gen Z. LNGenZ.com is your portal for news, videos, and worksheets without the spin. LNGenZ.com. A free thinking future starts here.